Welcome. I'm Samantha Lindsay Ahmed, and I'm a content developer in Microsoft Learning. My background is more education and humanities focused, and I have much awe and admiration for developers, engineers, and technical people who happen to be women. This series, Cloud Gal, is a way to highlight the work and experience of some of Microsoft's female developers and technical workers, with a goal of providing young girls and adult women curious about the tech industry with incentive to follow through on a technical career. We also want to provide women and men some visibility into the experiences of women in tech and to showcase Microsoft Cloud services from a developer's perspective. I grew up with a Commodore 64 playing Zork and writing simple programs to spell my name out repeatedly on a dot matrix printer. Juana Platone, our guest today, however, grew up being a national math Olympian in Romania and knowing from an early age that she wanted to pursue math and technology. One thing I was curious about when first meeting with her was whether she was encouraged to pursue a technical educational path or how the opportunities were made available to her to pursue this path. Juana made it clear that she needed no encouragement because she loved math and thought about things mathematically from a very, very early age. And it came natural for her to follow her interests. Juana is now a senior developer working on Azure Service Fabric, Microsoft's distributed systems platform, which is a middleware platform for building and managing enterprise-class, Tier 1, cloud-scale applications. Welcome, Juana.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Sure. Before we talk about you, perhaps you can give us a mini lesson on Azure Service Fabric and your role in developing it.
I'd love to. Azure Service Fabric is, like you said, distributed system platform that makes it very easy for developers to build, package, deploy, and manage highly scalable and highly available microservices. There are a lot of buzzwords in here, I know. So what it really does, down to earth here, is just allows developers and administrators to focus on their application logic instead of the infrastructure work. So usually, when people wrote the old kind of services and applications, they didn't have to think about cloud. Now things change with the cloud because you do not own the hardware. Failure is a given. I mean, given how many machines there are, how many VMs we have in the cloud, the fact that one or two or three or I don't know how many will fail at one point in time is inevitable. And then scale is unpredictable. Is it important to scale efficiently? Then managing the services in the cloud is most of the times much harder than writing those services. So you need the right visibility into what's going on, and you need to be able to take actions to fix whatever is wrong. So one of the actions would be upgrades, is to be able to push things, fixes, and new customer features, customer requests very quickly. And you have to do that with no downtime. Then there are other things like security. You must be thinking about it upfront. You have to understand the cost and control them. And it's also a matter of productivity. How much do you spend on writing the app and investigating problems, and how much you spend on the platform itself, the distributed platform itself. So if we want to compare the, like I said, I use the buzzword microservices. To be fair, we started working on this platform way before all these buzzwords came into play, so I don't feel bad that I'm using them. So before, we had one big monolithical application. And what is that application? You had a couple of layers in it, like the web, the data, the logic, the business logic. And you have all of it in one application. So many teams worked on parts of it, and then they have to come together and put the app together. And then how would you scale this? Well, you take the whole big thing, you put it on a VM or a machine or whatever, and that's it. That's your environment. Mm-hmm. And how you scale it, you take another big machine, you put the app on it, and now you have two of them, so you have scale. Well, this does not fly in the cloud. So that's why microservices are really important, because now you take your big application and you break it down into services. And these services contain one piece of logic, and people are able to work on it separately. The microservices interact through well-defined contracts and messages, so they are loosely coupled. And the important part is how you scale them. Now, Azure Service Fabric takes a couple of VMs and creates a ring out of them. And for scale out, scale down, people can put more machines or take more machines depending on their needs. And it makes it all very easy and very cost efficient. Now, on those VMs, what Service Fabric do, it puts services of that application that is built on microservices, and it just spreads them around. And it uses the VMs the best way possible. So it reduces the cost. Now, I can go in and talk about the types of microservices. We have stateless and stateful. And just let me know how deep, because I can talk all day about this.
Well, can you talk a little bit about like what you do on the team or how you contribute to Service
sure.
Fabric?
So like I mentioned, the upgrades, people need to be able to push things out to production very quickly and without affecting the customers. What we have is monitored upgrades. So you have one version of your application running in the cloud, and you want to deploy and run a new one. So you would issue a command to Service Fabric to start the monitored upgrade. So what Service Fabric does then, it goes UD by UD, upgrade domain by upgrade domain. And when it does an upgrade domain, it ensures that the application is always available. So it makes sure that there's a quorum of replicas always up and running and be able to address customer requests. And so we call this safety checks. There are a lot of safety checks, not only quorum of replicas, but seed nodes, and let's not delve into too much. I don't want to overwhelm. But the point is we make sure that it's safe and we stay there on that upgrade domain until it's safe to move forward. If everything is fine, we usually go through it very quickly. And once we finish an upgrade domain, we need to determine, is it okay to move forward? And what does is it okay mean? It means, did the health of the application degrade it, right? Is the new version that you want to deploy good or not? Because there are many, many times when you have a bug in your application and you're not able to find it in your simple tests. So it's very important to not roll that application out. So at that point, when you stop and figure out, hey, can we continue or not, if the application became unhealthy, we roll back automatically to the previous good version. Otherwise, we move forward with the other upgrade domains until we finally complete the upgrade. So the part that I'm working on is the health subsystem, which is actually the one that decides, is it okay? Cool. The one that decides, is it healthy still? So what the health subsystem is a scalable service that receives health reports from different components, from system components and watchdogs in the system, and creates a hierarchy view of all the entities in the cluster, all the services, applications, replicas, everything in the cluster, and is able to evaluate and tell you, is it okay or not to move on? So the health subsystem is used for upgrade. Well, it was originated because our needs at upgrade time to determine whether we're still good, but it's used also for monitoring, for alerting if something goes bad, and many more scenarios.
Wow. So you were with Service Fabric way back in the beginning, before it was even...
Oh, yes. I started, I think when I started, we were about 12 developers or something like that in the team. Yeah. Back in the days, it was called an overlay, the overlay team. And actually, coming back to what you said, that I knew exactly what I wanted to do. When I interviewed to come to this team, in the first informational, somebody in the team, I think it was Richard Hasha, who just presented me. So here's what we need to do. We take this ring, we take this machine, and here this machine figures out where that machine. And I was like so hooked. I'm like, oh my God, I want to be here. I don't want to be anywhere else. I really, really, this wow. is the place for me. Yeah. So I think that's the moment when you realize that, yeah, that's the right place to be in. So I've started then, and the team throughout the time has been very dynamic, and we have changed a lot. We have done a lot of innovative things.
How big is it now?
I think we're close to 100 or something like that developers. So
from
yeah.
12.
Yeah. So we grew a lot, and we're actually still growing because we have a lot of customers, internal and external. So the requirements are more and more, and seems like it's still the place to be.
So one of the trendy terms that's been floating around is DevOps. Are you familiar with DevOps?
Of course.
Does your team practice DevOps?
So keep in mind that we started as a V1 project. Mm-hmm. So as a V1 project in Microsoft, you need to be agile and you need to prove yourself. You either ship it or you sink, right? There is no in between. So we as a team have started as being very agile and we continue to be very agile. And our philosophy was that we ship first to internal customers that run at a high load. And if we can prove that the system runs at those loads, at the Microsoft needs, and we flush out all the bugs in the system through this, when I go out to customers, we already are a battle-proof platform. So that's what we did. We actually found teams in Microsoft that were willing to take a dependency on us when we are a V1 project. And that doesn't happen much in Microsoft. So that was a really big deal. Hmm. For example, we find SQL Azure that took a dependency on us. And we worked together for a long, long time. And now, at one point, we gained a lot more internal customers, and the requirement for DevOps came. We didn't have any CSS because we're not an external project. So what we did, developers was the first line, right? So any interaction, any incident came first to developer team. So that was our DevOps thing.
So is that like the live side?
Yes, live side. So I think that was an amazing experience. I think it was really necessary because what you gain is you see the customer pain point immediately. So you put a bug in, you ship it, then, I mean, you put it in production, and then immediately someone calls you, hey, at 2 a.m. and night, things are not working, fix them,
yeah.
Right? So you go in and you feel the pain because what happens, some bugs are really hard to come with compatibility or whatever issues. We had this kind of situation. For example, we had a bug at one time when we moved from one version to another. There was a compatibility version in some things, and then the new system wouldn't come up. We'd just check some state and say, hey, I'm not familiar with this state, go down. So it was in a loop. Come up, not good, go down, up, down, up, down. So try to mitigate that, you know. It makes you really think about, hey, compatibility and all that.
Yeah.
So we've learned a lot as a team from DevOps. We had some challenges as well, and we changed, we made the process work for us. I think it's one of the things that I love in this team. We are making the processes work for us. So one of the things which changed, as an example, when we started, we said, we have a different on-call shift than other teams. We usually a team, one person is primary for a week. We are only primary for a day, and then three more days we're backups.
So what does that mean?
That means in that when you are primary, you're the one that addresses every incoming incident.
Just one person?
One person, but it has the backups.
Okay.
So the first, you have the previous backups, and then you are primary, and then you're the first backup for the next primary, and so on.
I see.
So you help as needed. So you're not primary, therefore you're alone, because you have the backups, but you are the first point of contact. And at the beginning, we had the idea that the one that answers the incident takes it all the way through, right? It makes sure that it doesn't matter how long it takes. It took a week or whatever. That person handles the mitigation, handles the root causing, and handles everything about the incident. Hmm. And with this, we figure out that it's not the right way to go because the person may not be the subject matter expertise. Mm-hmm. So it took longer to mitigate because that person need to search through a OneNote with, hey, here's what to do in that situation. And it took more time to figure out what to do. So we changed things a little bit. So we said, okay, if you're on call and you have an incident that is a high severity incident, you immediately pull in the subject matter expertise. And then after that for root causing, you also, it's a good idea to put your data in, but then also involve the people that know more about that area so that it can investigate in way bigger depth than with that you could do. So that works better for us now. And it's also another thing that we've learned is figure out things that you could do better, right? So for example, how could I figure out in a shorter time the same amount of information that I had? So I'm on call, I need to figure out this information as soon as possible. What health reports I can send so that the problem is visible sooner. Mm-hmm. So we took actions on this. So
do you still practice Agile? Do you do like stand-ups? And
no, actually Agile for us were never about stand-ups. It was a matter of deliver quick and fast. Mm-hmm.
Do you practice like any of the DevOps, like continuous integration, continuous testing?
We do have things like that, and we have a lot of canary clusters. So let's talk a little bit about history. Like I said, we had internal customers, mm-hmm. Lots and lots of internal customers. That's how we proved ourselves. And then we created our own cluster. The problem with customers having their own cluster was that we could not tell them, I mean, we could tell them upgrade the bits to newer version, but mm-hmm. they could or could not depending on their schedule, right? So we had incidents when they were running on an old version of the cluster with bugs that have already been fixed, mm-hmm. and we had to address them anyway. So we moved to our own cluster. We have a resource provider, Azure resource provider, running on that cluster. So we have the compute resource provider, network resource provider, and so on and so forth. They're mm-hmm. running in our clusters.
Okay.
And we manage that. And we on calls go to all of them. And then we have now external customers. And external customers, they own their own VMs, and we're running on them. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is there. Sorry, is that you cannot actually access their information. It's their information, it's their VM, so we mm-hmm. need permission. Mm-hmm. So we had all kinds of a spectrum of different processes to go through.
Are you still working out all of those processes? Or?
Oh, I think most of them, well, we still improve, for example, for customers or how to get traces and things like that. But I think most of the processes are pretty well established by now.
So what's the future of Service Fabric?
Well, like I said, we still have many more customers onboarding every day. I think the greatest thing about this product that really, really makes me excited to come to work is that it addresses a real customer problem. I mean, writing distributed systems is hard. And many internal people that took dependency on us, they know why they did it. No. Because they tried it first and they figured out this is hard. Mm-hmm. Like we cannot do it. Mm-hmm. And that's why, I mean, in the time frame they had, it's impossible to focus on what their application is to do and what the platform is to do. So yes, I think we're onboarding customers all the time. And there are new features coming in Service Fabric to address the customer needs. For example, we have container support in preview. Mm-hmm. We plan to GA have
the yeah. How's general. That going?
It's going really well, actually. We plan to be one of the best container orchestrator out there. So we have some work to do. We're working. Mm-hmm. but it's coming. It's coming along. We have support for Linux coming. Mm-hmm. It's also in preview right now. And we also put in more and more features as customer requests come in or as we see fit to bring the platform forward.
Well, let's talk a little bit about like your experience as a woman on the team. Are there many women in your team or org?
I think things have changed a lot. So when I joined the team, I was the only woman, developer woman. And for many, many years, I've been the only developer woman in the room. I think at one point we had 2 women out of 30 developers. Now there are many more women. Hmm. I would say about maybe 10 or even
out
more.
Out of 100?
I think more than that. 15?
15, okay.
Yeah, so I think things are changing. I see more. But I think it depends a lot of teams and whatever that team is doing and how it knows to attract women. Mm-hmm. So my experience as a woman, I actually have never focused on being a woman in the team. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I've been treated differently because I'm a woman. And even in my interaction today with the other women in the team, I don't do anything different between interacting with the men and interacting with the woman. So I've never felt marginalized in any way. Mm-hmm. Now, there have been some challenges here and there.
Do you want to speak to those or?
Well, there was this weird moment when, so I was still in Overlay and they decided, well, the management up there were decided that, hey, we will take the whole Overlay team and put it in clustering team because that's where you can address more needs.
Mm-hmm.
So we were in building 4 and we were supposed to meet with the clustering team in 34. So me and some colleagues started working from building 4 to building 34. We arrived at the team meeting, which was a small conference room with about 24 chairs. We are more than 24, added the clustering team and the overlay team.
Okay.
So we arrived between the first, I sat down, Alex, which was my colleague from overlay, sat next to me, and there was a chair, an empty chair next to me. The clustering starting coming in, and they took all the available chairs, and they started sitting next to the walls, next to the windows. There was one chair left, the one next to me. None of the people sat down. They all came in, looked at me like I was some kind of alien, and then just, and then later, that was really weird. One of my colleagues in the overlay team was late. He came in. He looks around, he understands the situation, laughs a little bit, sits next to me, goes, thank you, Anna. Okay. Yeah, that was kind of weird, but didn't happen much, though.
It sounds like that wasn't the norm, though.
No,
it was
no.
Experience. So overall, you wouldn't say you've ever felt like you were treated differently? Or
no.
You've had any specific challenges related to being a woman on the team?
I have challenges specific to being myself. I don't know because I'm a woman or not. It's hard to say. I mean, there are some traits that they say they're specific to women, but mm-hmm. I don't know if I have more of them or less of them. I don't know. Like confidence. I lacked confidence for a long time at the mm-hmm. beginning. Woman thing or not, I don't know. It is what it is.
Were you able to get over that? Or
experience helps.
Yeah.
Just learning and just knowing that, hey, I know the best in this field. Mm-hmm. I used to go in meetings and not talk until one day somebody talked about my component saying that it says something that it didn't. I'm like, what? Hold on there. Let me tell you how things work.
Yeah.
So yeah, once you know and the confidence comes.
And you feel more confident now.
About the things that I know,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And about the things I don't know, I can ask.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it definitely, I changed, I matured.
And does your team or org have support for women? Or?
There are a lot of programs organized by the org. It's actually quite amazing. We have the CNE organizes 1 degree program mm-hmm. where they encourage women to take leadership and actually organize events themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you can organize whatever event you want, like taking people to a movie or some educational things like painting your nails, even. It does not matter. They're meant as...
To build a community.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Events to bring women together so that they can talk, so they
I think that was originally funded by Bill Lang.
Yes,
yes.
I think so.
Yeah, and it's still going.
Yes, it's
That's
still
great.
Going.
That's great.
Yes, it's a great program. And more than that, what I really like is the Azure Leadership Council.
Is that a women's leadership council?
Yes, I think there is a women-specific part of it. And they organize this kind of trainings that are specifically for women.
Mm-hmm.
And there are general topics, but they are approached from a woman's perspective. And they focus more on how women think. And I found them very, very useful.
Mm.
There are events like managing your career and all kinds of things that are very... down to earth with specific steps and what you can do. I find them very, very good.
So let's talk a little bit about like how you got here, like going way back, like how you were even encouraged to pursue computer science or as a child. You're from Romania, correct? So how did you get started on this path?
Well, if we are to start at the beginning, let's start at the beginning. So I grew up in a very small village in Romania where most of the people were doing agricultural thing. So do you know the things we do today for the kids, taking to martial arts and arts class and whatever class? There was no such there was not one single person in my village that could have known anything about this. So there was no kind of classes. My parents were kind of the biggest fish in the pond, which doesn't say much because the pond was very small and the people were very poor. Mm-hmm. So I started school in first grade. I went to my local school and I was the best. Man, I rocked the thing. And at the end of first grade, at the end of first grade, my mom realized she's not learning anything there. So that school was for very poor kids. I mean, it was our neighborhood, right? She's not learning there. So she took me to another school in the center of the village, and that was better. I had to take a bus, and do not think school bus. I took the bus like everybody else was taking the bus, and it was one bus that came every 1 hour
or so. Like the adult bus.
The adult bus, every 1 hour, you miss the bus, you're done. Go home.
Was this like a private school or?
No, it was just the main school. It was bigger and it was in the center of the village. So at least, you know, you had people from, well, more educated people with kids coming to that school. So yeah, that was my first experience with buses. I think about 4 years I had nightmares that I'm going to miss my bus.
Wow.
So, as a
little girl, you were taking this big bus by yourself.
Yeah, I had to take the bus. And then I started the school, and guess what? I didn't rock anymore. So my mom took a week of vacation, and in that week of vacation, she stayed home with me, and we did math problems. She invented math problems, starting with, I have three apples and you have six, how many do we have together? And ending with, I have three apples, you have six, how many do you need to give your sister? So we all have the same number. Mm-hmm. All kinds of simple problems like that. And then in the fourth grade, we are starting to have this math contest. In the fourth grade, it was only at the school level. And I got a 10, which was the highest grade. It's like the A here. But we have a system from 1 to 10. Mm-hmm. So 10, that means I have no mistakes.
Okay.
And then from the fifth grade, I moved to another school, high school, basically. But it was a pre-high school kind of school, which was in the closest
city. And were you rocking here?
Yes, I rocked through all those years. Okay. It was good. So in the fifth grade, I went to the big city. And we had the same bus, except now I rode it longer. And I remember we started school at 7:30. The bus was at 6:30. So I woke up at 5, you know, do all the thing in preparation, go to the bus station, wait for the bus to come, and then go to it. It was kind of annoying, especially when we got out of school. We got out at 1:30. My bus was at 3:30. So 2 hours I had to just sit around and wait for the bus. It was not the best experience. But school was better, and I learned a lot. And I had a great math teacher that instilled my love of math. And starting with higher classes, we had the math contest, not just on school level, but also on county and then national. And I got to national, and that was an amazing opportunity for me. It opened a lot of doors because at the county level, we had some kind of prizes for talented kids where they pulled together all the kids from different arts or math or all kinds of subjects, and we were taken to visit different places. So I managed to visit Austria and Turkey. My parents never left the country.
Wow.
So I actually...
Didn't go with you?
No, that was just for the kids, right? But I'm saying that they never ever visited anything at that point in time. So I managed to get out of the country before them. Mm-hmm. It was really, really amazing. And on top of this, we had regional math contests. So basically, it was a city where someone organizing the contest, and then the people from all over the country came there. And it was one day when we had a test. But other than the test, it was a week of fun, basically. I don't know, geeky or not, but it was really fun. Mm-hmm. It was a great experience for me. Not to mention the high school, and then I entered university. I didn't have to take the test. So all my summer was really relaxed because I had been to the math contest and I took the third prize or something like that. So yeah, it was very a good experience for me.
And was it like normal there for women to pursue math? Like it wasn't?
It was not a discussion of women versus men. If you had the brain power, you could do it. Everyone support you in the exact same terms. There was no kind. I never felt that women are pushed less or more than men.
Mm-hmm. So then you went to university.
Yes,
there.
I went in Bucharest.
Okay,
University Polytechnica of Bucharest.
And then
in computer science, I finished with the third grade on the entire university.
Wow.
And then impressive. I got married in the last year. My husband got a job at Microsoft. So he came here, I came too. I got a job soon, but I didn't have the right to work. So I had to wait from February till October to start working. And that's when I learned that I really am not a stay-at-home person. I felt so useless, like I'm not bringing money. You have to remember that I come from a situation where we were poor enough that there was no option for someone to stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you didn't have enough money for that.
Yeah.
So I felt like, oh my God, I'm not bringing anything to the table. I'm a failure. Yeah, so I've learned that that's not for me.
So even just 5 months, that's all you took off and it wasn't enjoyable?
No, not at all.
I think some people would enjoy 5 months.
I think I would enjoy 5 months now.
No,
But at that time, I didn't
have. You were ready.
Yeah.
So which team? So your first job was at Microsoft?
Yes, I started in ASP.NET team, in the stress team. I was in a weird position because I was not a tester, but I was not a dev.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, those were the two.
Yep.
I was at the stress team, which had a special kind of position. But it was very interesting. We did a lot of debugging, a lot of investigations. And I remember a funny thing. I went on the vacation the first time in that team. And I had my out-of-office message saying, if you have a stress problem, please visit your doctor. Everybody was, oh.
Really?
Yeah. And it was my first attempt at humor. I toned it up. A lot of things. And then I moved to the overlay team, and like they said, the rest is history.
So do you have any advice or any words of wisdom that you would give to young girls thinking about computer science, or even adult women looking for a career in IT?
Well, for me, it was follow my passion, right? Because it spoke to me. When I started computer science, it was all so crystal clear and so concise, and you do this and this happens. It was just speaking to me somehow. So I just followed that passion. It came easy.
You have a family?
Yes, I have two amazing little boys, loud boys. Liam is 3 years old and Damon is 5 years old. And I now understand how people say before kids was an era, after kids is an era. Yeah, I understand now.
Did that change the way you work and your experience at work?
Oh, yes, a lot. Before, basically, we had no constraints. We're two working adults.
You could stay as late as you want. And
we had the kids and the priority changed. So now my priorities are family, then gym, and then work. So mornings and evenings, I spend them with my kids. There is no working overtime for me. During that time, I do not accept anything.
Mm-hmm.
Unless there are emergencies, and then you do what you need to do. But it's mostly kids. And then my second priority is gym. And
going to the gym.
Yes. Mm-hmm. When the kids were small, things were really, really, really hard. Because they are 2 years apart. And my oldest did not accept my youngest.
Mm.
So it was extremely challenging. And you could not leave them alone for 1 minute. So all those added up. Plus, we don't have any help here. But now that they grew up, I said, okay, gym is a priority for me because it makes me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the very good advices that I've learned. Don't prioritize your schedule. Schedule your priorities. So that's exactly what I did when I decided, okay, gym is important for me.
Mm-hmm.
I put it on my calendar. So I know 3 days a week, this is the block that I have for gym. And nothing else comes over. I go to the gym, and then I feel much better, much more refreshed, so I'm able to focus better. So I think it's good even for my work.
Did you go to the gym before you had kids, or is this something?
Yes.
Okay.
I always enjoyed going to the gym, but I took a big chunk of out time while the kids were growing, because there was just no way.
And do you think that balancing all of that has had any impact on your career growth or career trajectory?
I do not know. But I can tell you that what I did was true to myself, true to my priorities, true to my belief, and I would not change it for anything in the world. Mm-hmm. So I actually never asked for a promotion, and they just came. And that's another thing. The reason I stayed in this team for so long is because I love people. A lot of them have been from since the beginning or close to the beginning, and they're senior, and we grew together, basically.
That's unusual at Microsoft for
it's very
people
unusual.
To stay that long.
And it's because all of us really believe in what we are doing, in the product. And I think we build a team that it's highly connected, and we respect each other very, very much. And one of the things my manager told me at one point, do the right things, and the right things will happen. So I never asked for a promotion. I just did my job. I did the best that I could all throughout, and I just got promotions. They just regular, normal cadence. So I don't know if it hurt
me
or not.
So you never had that conversation with your manager of like, I want to get promoted, or what are the next steps in my career?
No. Wow. I don't really like to talk about career that much. Just kind of, if I try to, is there a possibility of not talking? I'm taking it. but since I've been with the same manager for 8 years, so we kind of sort of know each other a lot.
So you've proven yourself more by your...
actions, yeah, and like I said, this team is great. Like, the people in general, we support each other very much. So let me give you an example. We had, because we were talking about DevOps earlier, I had an incident. I was primary on call. It was 4 p.m. I have this incident coming. There was an Azure upgrade going on in a cluster, and this customer was affected. It could not connect to their machines, so on and so forth. So I'm looking at the traces, trying to figure out what mitigation to apply, and I ask Alex, who was sitting next to me, hey, Alex, do you have an idea what this trace means? How can we change things here? He was not on call. So he took a look, and then it became 5 p.m., 6 p.m. My husband already picked up those kids. I told him. He's very supportive. And we support each other, basically, because we both have emergency from time to time, so we support each other. And Alex stayed online with me the whole entire night.
Wow.
He was not on call. He was just there. And then about 8 p.m., we figured out, hey, this component, this doesn't seem right. So we called he was online, so we called another guy. He joined. He stayed all the night with us.
And he wasn't on call either.
He wasn't on call either. So what happened in that cluster, they were running with very old bits, and they had some reliability issues. We had some reliability issues that we already fixed in newer versions, but because they were in old versions, they were still affected. And when the Azure brought down the machines, it caused a lot of instability because they were running at the cluster's capacity. So they could not tolerate any more happenings that were unusual in the system. So we actually stayed up the whole entire night trying to mitigate. And to see the contrast between our team and other teams, on the other side, there was one single guy. There was their incident, not ours, right? Because we could say, hey, you're an outdated version of Service Fabric and you were running over capacity. There's nothing we can do.
Yeah.
But we didn't. We tried to recover that cluster. And there was one guy, and he was afraid to do mitigations. Like, should we bring this down? No, we should not. What can we do? I don't know. Maybe we should involve. But he didn't call anybody. He didn't have any support in his team. So I think these are the little things that matter. It's just you have an incident where you're busy with somebody, and somebody just comes and asks, hey, do you need help? Just out of the blue.
So do you have any role models or inspirations that you use to keep you going?
Sure. There were a lot of people that I admired. Some were developers that I worked with or that I saw that were doing a lot of things that I would want to do. But actually, one of my inspiration is my manager, Vipul Modi. He's amazing at taking one big task, breaking into pieces, and doing it. He just gets things done. And it's amazing. He can pull in people. He can motivate. He can drive. It's an inspiration to me. Another person that I've admired a lot was a mentor that I had. It's actually a person that I met at a conference for women.
Mm-hmm.
I just noticed her. I liked the way she talked, the way she presented herself. And I approached her and I said, would you like to be my mentor? And she said, yes.
Somebody outside of Microsoft?
No, she wasn't Microsoft, but she was a director.
I see.
Way above my pay grade. I know what they say. So it was amazing to talk to her because I was coming to her with this, I have this problem and I don't know how to approach it. And she would be able to take that problem apart and come up with steps for me to do. And I've tried to take some of the teachings that she gave me and apply them throughout my life. That was really, really helpful for me. And not least, my gym instructor from Below the Bell class, Donny Ray. She's an amazing woman. And the reason I go to the class, I don't go just for the exercise, also for the mental help that she
gives.
What
kind of class is it?
It's weight and aerobics together. She brings herself to each class. And more than herself. She's always so enthusiastic. And she always has these words of wisdom that she just throws here, there. It's amazing. You go there and you just come out so full of life, so full of energy. And she just, I would very much want to be that enthusiastic and come to work with my whole self the way she does. It's
wow.
Amazing.
Inspiring.
It's extremely inspiring, I know. And There are all kinds of quirks, like, for example, do you know how people say that time fixes everything?
Mm-hmm.
She said, no, it does not. Intention does. Time and intention can fix anything. But don't just sit there dwindling your time to expect things to change, because really, there's life here.
I might have to check that out.
Yeah, no, she's really, really, really good. I love her. There are so many inspirations, like, when we're working really hard and she tries to push us and she says, this is a challenge. And do you know, if you look in challenge, you'll see the change word in there. Just picture it in your head, challenge, and you see the change word. And yes, to change, you need to challenge yourself. Go ahead. I know it's hard. You're not here to be easy. Keep going.
Do you do any mentoring?
I do have mentees, and I have some in my teams. I had some other mentees from other teams. I find that it's a very good exercise for me as well, not just to teach them, but I also learn a lot from them. Mm-hmm. I think it's very useful.
Well, I think we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Sharing everything that you shared. Please tune in to Channel 9 for the next episode of CloudGal in March. Thank you for watching.